After some false starts, the relationship between Malabo and Tel Aviv ripened. The more Obiang's ministers and advisers learned about Israel, the more they identified with the country. Equatorial Guinea, too, was a small country surrounded by enemies. A global power like the United States could provide useful advice about defense strategy, but Israel's advisers understood intuitively what it was like to be tiny, threatened, and unpopular. Among other problems, Equatorial Guinea struggled with coup-making conspiracies in West Africa that Obiang and his advisers believed were financed by networks of Lebanese traders. By retaining Israel for defense and intelligence advice, some of Obiang's advisers felt, they would be sending a message to all potentially hostile Lebanese: we know who you are. By 2009, the Israelis had sold Equatorial Guinea electronic surveillance equipment and taken orders for armed speedboats, to be delivered in 2011. The defense ministry also acquired two small Ukrainian frigates that could carry a helicopter to sea. Regime protection was a visible priority. Bodyguards at Obiang's mainland palace practiced for would-be assassins at an outdoor shooting range mounted with human-sized silhouetted targets. Some international diplomats in Malabo felt the Israeli trainers were not particularly helpful to their efforts to coax Obiang and his advisers toward political reform and the elimination of torture as a policing method. Ex-Mossad officers doing business in Equatorial Guinea tended to exude a crush-your-enemies ethos that did not include much discourse about civil rights. The Israeli cooperation was not limited to defense and intelligence, however. Obiang also paid Israel to build and fully staff a modern hospital on the Equatorial Guinean mainland. Israeli doctors and nurses earning very healthy salaries provided international standards of care. As his oil cash flow swelled, Obiang also bought attacked Hind helicopters and rented out pilots and maintenance crews from Ukraine. The contracts provided that Ukrainian pilots would train local counterparts, so that each helicopter crew would eventually have one Ukrainian and one Equatorial Guinean at the controls in the event of hostile action against an invading force. Unfortunately, during one actual emergency, when gun-wielding Nigerian criminals arrived in Equatorial Guinea in fishing boats to rob local banks, the Equatorial Guinean co-pilot did not turn up fast enough to give chase. A fully armed Hind followed the escaping bank robber's boat into the Atlantic, with only a Ukrainian in the cockpit. According to reports that circulated afterward in Malabo, when Equatorial Guinean officers speaking by radio ordered the pilot to fire, the Ukrainian declined, declaring that the direct trigger-pulling use of lethal force was not provided for in his training contract. In Washington, Obiang's lobbyists at Cassidy & Associates tried to keep the momentum of cooperation with the Bush administration moving. At state, their strategy was to argue, referring to Equatorial Guinea's president, who had now been in power for more than 25 consecutive years, "I'm not telling you this is a good guy, I'm telling you that he's willing to change." To prove the point, during one meeting with high-ranking state officials in late 2005, Obiang awkwardly handed over a check for $4 million to pay for development work in his country that would be carried out by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Normally, USAID used American taxpayer funds to assist poor countries. Obiang said he would be willing to cover America's expenses if the agency would help to improve his country. The gesture, and diligent pushing by Cassidy's advocacy team, helped win Obiang a second visit to State Department headquarters, this time to meet with Condoleezza Rice, Bush's Secretary of State during the president's second term. Obiang still maintained a residence in suburban Maryland and frequently visited the United States. A date was set for an April morning when Obiang was in the Capitol. To prevent unwelcome publicity, both sides agreed that while Rice would receive Obiang formally in her office on State's seventh floor, and two official photographers would record the meeting so that Obiang could display authenticating pictures back home, the meeting would otherwise be private. It would not be listed on Rice's public schedule, and there would be no press notification. As Obiang climbed into his car to ride to Foggy Bottom, one of his lobbyists' cell phones rang. It was a reporter. "I hear your guy is going to be at a press conference." The Cassidy team was stunned. Privacy had been negotiated and agreed upon, they thought. There were three places at state headquarters where the secretary, by protocol, could greet an official visitor. Outside, at the dignitary's car door. Inside the main lobby, at the elevator. Or up on the seventh floor, at the secretary's office. Cassidy and Bush administration officials had agreed that to maintain secrecy, Obiang would travel up to Rice's office to be met there, out of sight. Why, then, would Rice's office have notified reporters of the meeting? The reason, Cassidy's lobbyists were told later, was that the Bush White House had decided that morning that Rice needed urgently to make a public statement about Iran, and that she needed to do so in the morning, Washington, D.C. time, so that it would be carried on evening news broadcasts in the Middle East, which was roughly 8 hours ahead. The Obiang visit, scheduled for 10 a.m., presented the best opportunity for Rice to get her statement out. So the word had gone out to attract the press to an event that was supposed to be off the schedule. Obiang and Rice did talk privately at first. Seated in the secretary's office, with other state officials and note-takers present, Rice asked for Obiang's help with diplomatic efforts to calm violence in Sudan's Darfur region. She asked, too, if Equatorial Guinea would vote to support Guatemala's candidacy for membership on the United Nations Security Council. Obiang told her that he had sought closer ties with the United States government for a long time. Rice asked Obiang about his top priorities, and the president mentioned health, sanitation, and education. The secretary commented favorably on Equatorial Guinea's improvements on the education front, as a summary of the conversation put it. In fact, according to United Nations statistics cited by the World Bank, Equatorial Guinea's rates of enrollment and completion in primary school had declined between late 1994, before oil's discovery, and 2009, when the country's national per capita income was about $19,000.